I would encourage you all to take a look at ISEC's website, their organization's AIESEC, very interesting organization. Before we begin tonight, a couple of people I need to thank, a few organizations, namely ISEC, who is a co-sponsor of this program, also the Indiana University School of Law, and Professor David Williams, who's been integral in putting this program together this evening. They've helped us out a lot. But finally, the members of the executive committee of the Student Alliance for National Security, I'm indebted to all of you. I won't name you by name, that will take a little while, but you've put a lot of effort into this program and other programs we've done this year, and I'm very excited that we're able to do this event, so we can give those people a round of applause. Now, before we begin, let me remind you, after our guest this evening has finished speaking, he will be taking questions for a considerable amount of time. We have a microphone up here in the middle. I would just request that there be between 5 and 8 people lined up at the microphone at any time, no more than that. Also, we ask you to keep your questions as succinct and as clear as possible. Please just make sure to come up and ask a question as briefly as you can so we can move the process along. Now, as for our speaker this evening, let me tell you a bit about him. Ambassador Faisal Isfirbadi was born in Virginia, but he spent some of his child living in Baghdad with his family. In 1970, he returned to the United States, later attending Indiana University, where he earned his bachelor's degree in chemistry and where he attended the Indiana University School of Law. Living in Chesterton, he worked as a trial lawyer for 15 years, specializing in civil litigation and constitutional torts. In the year 2002, Isfirbadi joined the State Department's Future of Iraq project that focused on post-war planning in Iraq. And then in September 2003, he returned to Iraq to serve as an advisor to a member of the country's governing council. In that capacity, he was the principal legal drafter of Iraq's interim constitution. Ambassador Isfirbadi was appointed to his position of ambassador in the Iraqi Ministry of Foreign Affairs in 2004, and that same year he was appointed to his current position of Deputy Permanent Representative of Iraq to the United Nations. It is my great pleasure and honor to welcome Ambassador Faisal Isfirbadi.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be back here. It's a bit of a homecoming for me. I grew up in Bloomington, as you've just heard, and I not only attended the University School of Law, I actually managed to come out of graduate. Some of my classmates graduated with distinction. I graduated with the surprise of the faculty, but nonetheless. Anyway, I'm very grateful and honored to be here. My hope is to speak relatively briefly. Now, I'm a trial lawyer and a diplomat, so relatively briefly is just that, a relative term. But I will hopefully speak briefly with the hope, instead of lecturing, of engaging you in a conversation, and recalling that this is Indiana University, I expect a robust treatment. But keep in mind, I'm already limping walking in here, so with a bad foot, so hopefully I'll be able to limp no worse than I'd be. I want to talk a little bit about the... I should also say that my alma mater here has done something that is, I have my first order when I arrived as ambassador, before I arrived in New York, was to the man who had been chargé. And before I actually arrived in New York, I called him and I said, I want you to take the Iraqi flag down, because they were still flying the Iraqi flag with Saddam Hussein's handwriting on it. And I had brought with me the new Iraqi flag at the time, this is in 2004, which still contains the Allah, God is greater, but in the Kufi script rather than in Saddam Hussein's actual handwriting. It's a bit disappointing that in the poster, tonight, you've got Saddam Hussein's handwriting behind me, you know, not that my picture was going to sell any tickets to him. But I should point out that for those who are Arabic readers, that the current flag no longer has the Allahu Akbar takbir in Saddam Hussein's handwriting. It is in fact in the Kufi script, which was a script, I believe, my mother's in the audience, she will correct me if I'm wrong, which I believe was invented in Iraq. That, by the way, to segue into my talk, it tells you how much Iraq had become an extension, an alter ego of the person of Saddam Hussein, that when he put the takbir of the Allahu Akbar on the flag, he did not have it done in you know, by a calligrapher, but rather wrote it with his own hand and had it traced onto the flag. This is the extent to which the state of Iraq's identity as a state had receded and became subsumed into the person of Saddam Hussein. Perhaps we'll have a chance to talk about that later. There are a great many thoughts percolating around this country and others about what should occur in my country from this point forward. Obviously, violence continues to be a problem. Although the last 2 weeks, there has been reason to be optimistic that the violence may actually be, however horrible it may continue to be, may actually be on the decline. Too soon to tell, but there is at least reason to suppose that might be the case. One of the things that that's never been a favorite song.
Why in fact we were
Arequipa in 1920, or in 1917 when the British entered Iran. I'd be happy to get into that in questions and answers. But even if we were not, someone ought to notice that this is not 1920 anymore. This is 2007. And this is now 47 years into the existence of a modern state of Iran, discounting that we have the oldest recorded history of any nation in the world, a claim we can make easily since writing was invented in Iran. But again, even if we were an artificial state 87 years ago, that is not to say that we are one now. And in fact, we are not. I would ask you, what was so not artificial about 13 separate crown colonies creating rather cumbersome renamed United States of America, depending on where you want to draw that term, let's say in 1776. And yet, by the time Abraham Lincoln spoke at Gettysburg, he could speak about 47 years ago our fathers brought forth, etc. I should point out, incidentally, that there was a British plan in the 1860s precisely to dissolve the United States, to say, well, these people are in civil war, there's no point trying to hold it together. History worked out differently. In our case, first of all, the underlying assumption number two, which is also false, aside from our artificiality, is that there are three groups in Iraq, Sunni and Kurds. This, of course, overlooks the fact, number one, that there are not three groups in Iraq. There are, as the late Professor Woody Adreda, who founded the Department of Near Eastern Languages here at Indiana University, used to say, 27 ethnic and confessional groups in Iraq. Second of all, you cannot draw a map, on a map, a line and say, here's where the Shia live, here's where the Sunni live, here's where the Kurds live. We are very highly integrated. We're very highly intermarried. And, for instance, the largest Kurdish city in Iraq is Baghdad. There are at least 1 million Kurds in Baghdad. In the supposed Shia south, we have 1 million Sunnis living in Basra. One-third of the population in the city of Basra are Sunni. In Baghdad, it is a hodgepodge. So those who advocate the disintegration of the state of Iraq on ethno-sectarian grounds, in fact, are advocating for wholesale ethnic cleansing of regions of Iraq, which I think is a particularly obnoxious position for people to be taking in this age. But that's in fact what they're advocating. I would say, as an Iraqi, but also as a human being, enough of this kind of thinking. But I'm speaking as an Iraqi. The title is, of the talk is, what are the implications for the United States for disintegration in this context of what I'm speaking about in terms of failure, because I do regard the disintegration of Iraq as failure for all of us, whether it happens through force or otherwise. What are the implications for the United States? Well, first of all, let's view it from the perspective of the United States' interest in the region. I believe you would be seen as having forced the division of Iraq at the point of the battle, although I've done that one. Now, whether that's true or not is another story, but I believe that's how it will play throughout the Islamic world. That there are those who say now that it is that the United States entered Iraq in the first place, and I don't believe this for a moment. But there are those who say now that the United States came to Iraq in the first place in order to effectuate such a division. And so you have to contemplate how that will play in the region, and the effect that that will have on your foreign policy interests in the region. And that's not for me to suggest to you whether that is or is not in your interests. That's for you to decide. I'm speaking as your officer. But it is something that I would make you aware of that should inform your discussions here, it seems to me. I would suggest that that approach were adopted, and there are those in important positions in this country who advocate this position. Unfortunately, I can't mention names. I could when I spoke off the record earlier today, but I can't now. And I believe they need to be more aware of this particular case, the effect that it will have on the, whether it would further radicalize the region or not. I believe it would. There's also an express belief that if you sit and draw a map, a line on a map in Washington or in London, wherever, that line actually means something. And that is a premise that has to be examined. My question to you would be, for those who advocate this position, what is your expectation, what is the likelihood of your expectation being correct that Iraq will fall neatly into three zones if you did divide it? What is the likelihood of that? And my suggestion to you is that that is not at all a provable assertion. There is at least an equal likelihood that the subparts would themselves be likely to fall apart, to splinter. And you could easily imagine Iraq falling into a half dozen or more subparts. And the question there is, how would that affect your interests in the region? What would you be saying to the various other countries in the region, which are also composed of other more than one confessional group, which is virtually every country in the Middle East? There are significant Shia populations in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Bahrain, in the United Arab Emirates, in other parts of the Gulf. What precedent are you setting, even if you assume that Iran is not does not control, which I don't believe they do, the Iraqi Shia parties? What would message would you be sending in those countries to advocate this position? And I don't believe that the advocates of this position have thought that through clearly. What do you do with West Central Iraq? There are portions of Iraq which right now, in your government and mine now, are involved in a fight against al-Qaeda in Iraq. Advocates of this proposal and of an early withdrawal, to which I will come in a moment, by the United States, fail to consider that an early withdrawal from Iraq now and the partition of Iraq would likely result in Al-Qaeda controlling at least one of those sub-entities in West Central Iraq, so that you would have a Taliban-style emirate on the Jordanian border. And what effect would that have on your interests and on the larger Middle Eastern issues? I think we need to pause and contemplate some of these issues. And indeed, even within the Kurdish region, which has enjoyed much greater stability for the last 15 years, certainly much greater freedom, now having been under Saddam Hussein's thumb prior to 2003. You have to consider that Baghdad has played host for Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athists a centripetal effect, even within the Kurdish area, which after all, prior to 2003, the Kurds were not able to form a single government. They had two separate mini-states within the Kurds. that Kurdish, those two Kurdish ministries were not reunited until after the elections held in January of 2005. So that in a very real sense, Baghdad played, again, a centripetal role, not only in keeping the country together in 2005, but indeed even within the region that plays that role. So those who would tamper with these borders, which have been very stable for the last century, and I would argue, I'm guessing that there are many in the audience from the Middle East, but I would argue that the borders, the post-World War I state system, have been essentially crept into the consciousness of most of the people in the Middle East. You saw that in the Iran-Iraq War very clearly. The Iraqi people, Shia, Sunni, Kurd, thought of themselves as Iraqis first. They did not think of themselves, let's talk about the Shia, who of course are the majority of Iraq. They did not think of themselves as Shia first. They fought the Iranians as Iraqis, as indeed the Iranians of Arab descent in Kurdistan promised. The Iraqi army was slaughtered in Khuzestan, which is a predominantly Arab. It's an Iranian province, the descendants, the inhabitants of whom are predominantly Arab descent, yet they slaughtered the Iraqi army. They think of themselves as Iranians. There were no Kuwaitis cheering Saddam Hussein's tanks in 1990, August 2nd, 1990, either. So this state system has, for better or for worse, which has been now in effect in the Middle East for 100 years since the end of the First World War, has sunk in. Now, what is the effect of tampering with those borders? It seems to me that no plan, quote unquote, leads to a greater probability of catastrophic failure than this ill-conceived notion of the soft or hard partitions of Iraq. We'll put that to the side. I've lived here long enough that I am well aware that the mood of the United States and the public here in the United States has shifted dramatically with respect to the war in Iraq. And so I understand the debate that's going on in this country. And of course, as a foreign diplomat, I cannot and will not engage myself in a domestic discussion. I would ask some questions, however. There are those who are contemplating or who have proposed an early American withdrawal from Iraq. What message will that send regionally and internationally? Once again, you're fighting some, you and we are fighting together some real enemies there. Real enemies not just of the new order in Iraq, but indeed people who mean to defeat the United States, not only in Iraq, but elsewhere. You may well argue that about whether or not there was a presence in Iraq in 2003. Historians will have to continue that discussion. In 2006, it is not arguable that there is not a major presence in Iraq. It is, and we all know that it is. So, regardless of what the situation may have been in 2003, we have a situation in 2006 and now 2007 that we have to deal with. What does a premature withdrawal from Iraq look like? It seems to me that there is a real potential for catastrophic failure for all of us in the region, and for instability in the region that will make the last 60 years look like, peace and tranquility itself. So I think it's time for a genuine assessment, reassessment of where we are and how to proceed forward. Let me just spend a few more minutes talking about that, and then I'll bring my remarks to a conclusion and hope to engage you, as I said, in the conversation. Where we stand now is this. In the last several weeks, the surge of multinational forces, troops, principally American troops, has begun in the capital. Now, Baghdad is not merely, the capital in the sense of Washington, D.C. is the capital of the United States. It's a small, sort of vaguely sovereign city that's sort of quaint, with some nice monumental buildings. In Baghdad, depending on where you draw the borders or what you regard as about that, somewhere between one quarter and one fifth of Iraq's population, up to 7.5 million of our 28 million population live in Baghdad. Baghdad is key to Iraq. So that the concentration on Baghdad now is right. We have to get Baghdad right. The surge, which is a joint operation of the United States, and Iraqi forces, although of course the United States played the dominant role, for the obvious reason that we are now in the process of recreating the Iraqi army after its dissolution in 2003, has had some initial apparent success in Baghdad. Now, admittedly, one of the consequences of the surge has been that some violence has increased in areas outside of Baghdad. But that was predictable and understood going in. There has been some diminution of the violence in Baghdad. I don't want to overstate the case because it's too early to tell whether that is a real phenomenon which will have a lasting effect or whether it's temporary, perhaps even tactical. We'll have to wait and see. But even the Secretary General in his report to the Security Council on March 15th this year reported initial positive signs of a diminution in violence, number one, and equally important, a beginning of a return of some of the internally displaced within Iraq, returning to their homes in Baghdad. And so this is two extremely positive signs, and we trust and hope that it will be sustained. We recognize, however, we the Iraqis, as well as you, the American government, recognize that there is no purely military solution to the problems in Iraq, and that there is a military political component to the solutions. The insurgents in Iraq, it seems to me, can be divided into three categories. And I'm not trying to be, getting exactly right for purposes of speaking briefly here this evening. But broadly speaking, into three categories. One is al-Qaeda. Two are the Saddamists who wish to return Iraq to the carefree days when they had a stranglehold on power, and they want to return us to those days. These two groups have no negotiable political agenda. There is no political solution with these two groups. These two groups have, it seems to me, only a nihilistic agenda, bent upon and determined to destroy the political process in Iraq to the extent that we are attempting to build a democratic state in Iraq, keeping in mind that democracy is a process and not an end point. On the other hand, broadly speaking, there is a third, and the United Nations believes, the largest group of insurgents, which consists of Iraqi nationalists. Now some of these people, I believe perhaps even a majority, are fighting standing against precisely what they fear is the breakup of Iran. On this topic, see my remarks at the beginning. These people may well have a political agenda, and it may very well be, and I personally believe that it is possible to have a political dialogue with these people, to bring them into the political process, and to isolate the Saddamists and Al-Qaeda. This group cannot be sanguine at the targeting of Iraqi civilians, and I understand the heroic sacrifices of the sons and daughters of the United States, but keep in mind that for every American killed, there may well have been 100 Iraqis killed. That certainly has been true at times. I don't know if it's true throughout. In fact, I know it isn't true in that number. In the beginning, for every American, it was 20 or 30 Iraqis. But over the summer, last summer and fall, for every American killed, we were finding 100, 150 Iraqis being killed. The nationalists and the insurgency cannot be sanguine about this. And if they can be brought into the political process through legal process, a constitutional amendment process, which is also underway, through a reconciliation process, and there's now legislation that's been introduced by my government in that respect, we may well have an ability, and I believe we can succeed in isolating the other two groups that I've discussed. And finally, there has to be program for the economic development of the country, which I realize, given the headlines, it's off perhaps to be talking about the economic development of the country. Except that you have to realize, number one, that there are very large parts of the country that are largely Pacific. Certainly the Kurdistan region and certainly the South, sorry about that. We can and should have been all along talking about the economic development of those areas. Baghdad is as catch as can. As security improves, hopefully, we can talk about economic rehabilitation. It is essential that economic rehabilitation. Iraq should be, and but for a barbarous regime which mismanaged us horribly, and 15 years of unremitting sanctions, the most efficient sanctions imposed by the international community, sanctions we'll never see again against any other country. Not to the same extent. Now, Iraq, in fact, is one of the poorest countries in the world. So there is a multi-pronged approach to the solution of the problems. It takes time, it takes patience, it takes commitment, and I understand that the patience of the electorate in this country is on the way and not on the wax. But I would suggest to you that the alternative breeds a chaos in a world none of us want our children to live in. After spending 33 years in exile, returned, I think, 6 or 7 times. I would have to pause to count them, to Iraq 6 or 7 times since my first trip back, which was on April 27, 2003. I am profoundly moved by the determination of the people of Iraq never again to be ruled by tyranny. And their determination to get through these difficulties. I believe that the problems are soluble, broadly in terms that I've outlined here today. We can perhaps set some of the details in the question and answer period. We look to the United States and the international community to recommit to this enterprise. We believe we truly are now at the center of an enemy fearless of the United Nations. My Vice President came through New York about 3 weeks ago. We met with the Secretary General, who stated that he regarded Iraq as the most important brief that he had on his desk. I think it's too important and too much to say. Simply to put our hands up in the air and say, ah, well, this is too hard. In the end,
land in the very first instance. 28 million lives will be around the zero line. That's not an option for them. In any event, I look forward to giving you the topic of